it wasn't just about gay marriage. They banned any kind of civil union. So you're seeing, you know, gay couples that had gotten their, say, their health insurance through a public university in some of these states losing their health insurance, you know, adopted kids losing their health insurance. I think they would ultimately, you know, as they've shown over and over again by their objection to Lawrence v. Texas, they would like to make homosexual sex itself illegal. And then, you know, more significantly, they would like to have a lot of, or not more significantly, but maybe more broadly, they would like to have proselytization in the public schools. They would like to have this, they have a revisionist history of the United States, and it's part of this whole parallel reality that they've created. You know, they teach and believe and have, you know, kind of libraries of these textbooks full of falsities to kind of expound on this idea that the founders were conservative Christians who never intended to separate church and state, and that this is this fraud that's been perpetrated in the last 100 years. And so that's the kind of history that they would like to see being taught in the public schools. I think what they would like to see, again, is a kind of country where their version of evangelical Christianity was kind of understood to be dominant and understood to be a kind of, you know, maybe at the core of citizenship.
And give us a sense for how integrated this movement is in federal government.
One of the things that's been most significant about the Bush administration has been how much they've drawn on this movement to kind of fill the bureaucracy and find the people that make, you know, the thousand small decisions every day that ultimately constitute how the government works. So you see, you know, there's been a lot in the news lately about the, you know, the whole U.S. attorney scandal. And it's come out, you know, that one of the women who was very involved, Monica Gooding, was a graduate from Regent University, which is Pat Robertson's school, which is a school that, you know, teaches that there's no such thing as separation of church and state and uses a number of unabashedly theocratic texts. So there's, I think it's now, there's 150 graduates of Regent University in the federal government. You're seeing another school that I mention in this book is Patrick Henry University, Patrick Henry College, which is a college for homeschooling students started by a former disciple of Tim and Beverly LaHaye. And the idea behind this school is to kind of indoctrinate people into what they call a Christian worldview and then channel them into Washington, D.C. And at one point, this very small school, it's only about 7 years old, was providing 7% of the interns in the White House. And why this matters is because, again, the kind of decisions that are being made, whether it be somebody reprimanding a NASA scientist for referring to the Big Bang, you know, as already has happened, or somebody else, you know, kind of channeling hundreds of millions of dollars to anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers, which has also happened. You know, David Kuo, who was, you know, part of this movement and then kind of repented of that. He was the former second in command, the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. In his book, he wrote about, you know, a woman who's reviewing grants for the Faith-Based Initiative and who kind of told him laughingly at a dinner party, well, whenever I see one of those non-Christian groups, I just give them a zero. You know, so human, or, you know, another, even maybe a better example, at the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, there's been this kind of corruption of the Civil Rights Division. So the Civil Rights Division used to protect racial minorities, you know, African Americans from discrimination. They've seriously cut back on that and now spend almost all their resources looking into and prosecuting supposed anti-Christian discrimination.
And in fact, it sounds like from your book that a lot of the changes that are occurring are on a below the radar or at a very subtle level.
And that's what I've tried to get across, that this isn't, you know, about a kind of imminent theocracy. It's about a slow hollowing out of established institutions. So and then all of a sudden, and yes, very few people have paid that much attention to it, in part because a lot of it goes on at the local level, and in part because these regulatory changes are not nearly as kind of interesting or publicly inflammatory as some of these symbolic things about prayer in school and nativity scenes and that kind of thing. But the cumulative impact has been quite profound. You know, one of the stories that I tell in this book is about what happened at the Salvation Army in New York after Bush changed the regulations governing faith-based initiatives. I mean, this has been, you know, kind of one of the signature programs of the administration has been the channeling of hundreds of millions of dollars away from secular social service providers to faith-based social service providers. And it's not new for religious groups to contract with the federal government. You know, Catholic Charities has been doing it for a long time, Jewish Family and Children's Services, you know, Lutheran Social Services. What is new is that Bush has, by executive order has said, and it's very Orwellian, they call it religious freedom and hiring rights. It used to be that if you got federal money, you had to abide by the 1964 Civil Rights Law. The 1964 Civil Rights Law has an exemption for religious groups so that, you know, mosques can prefer Muslims, you know, churches can prefer Christians, and that's fine. But it used to be that you didn't get that exemption if you were, you know, getting government money to do social service work. You had to kind of establish a separation within the institution. Bush has removed that. So you're now seeing, a faith-based group can get a grant to, say, provide job training to prison inmates, and it can say in its help wanted ad, applicants must be Christian. And one of the ways that that's played out, and that really shocked everyone involved because they, you know, hadn't been aware of these kind of changes until all of a sudden they came crashing down on them, was that the Salvation Army in New York, which is one of the biggest social services division of the Salvation Army, it's about $50 million in public money to do group homes, foster care, adoption, drug treatment, all kinds of things. And the social service division had been quite separate from the kind of evangelical mission of the Salvation Army until Bush kind of gave them permission to integrate them. And what the Salvation Army did was it hired a consultant to Christianize the New York Social Services Division. And one of the first things he did, there was a woman there named Anne Lone who had been there for 24 years. And, well, actually, let me back up. One of the first things he did was go to the Human Resources Department. And, you know, he went to the boss. There was a woman there named Margaret Geisman. And he went to her boss and he said, you know, Margaret Geisman, is that Jewish? That sounds Jewish. And it wasn't Jewish. It's Catholic. And so then he went to Margaret Geisman and he said that he wanted to know who the gay people were and who the non-Christians were who were working there. And she, who's like a very conservative Catholic lady, refused to give him this information and was, you know, felt like this intense pressure and was eventually kind of almost hounded out, you know, eventually left. Meanwhile, this guy goes to Anne Lone, who's a Jewish woman who had been there for 24 years and ran the Children's Services Division. And he gave her this form that he wanted her to fill out and have all the hundreds of employees under her fill out. And it asked you to list your church, the churches you've attended for the last 10 years, the name of your pastor, his phone number so that they could contact him about your fitness to work with children. And she said, I'm not filling this out and I'm not having anyone else fill this out. And she thought this was illegal, obviously. And she stayed there for a few months until it kind of became intolerable. She said the climate became very hostile. She left. So now there's this lawsuit, you know, with 17 former employees of the Salvation Army who are suing and who the facts of the case are not particularly in dispute. What's basically in dispute is whether or not the government has the right to behave, or whether or not the Salvation Army has the right to behave this way. And the government's position is that it does, because again, religious freedom and hiring rights are kind of central to Bush's vision for the faith-based initiative. And, you know, I remember talking to Anne Lone. She was so stunned that A, this could happen in New York City of all places, and B, that it didn't make more of a splash, right? It was in the New York Times, it was on page A11, so that this, you know, wasn't a kind of, you know, that there wasn't a national outcry, you know, kind of maybe on par with, say, you know, the Don Imus scandal or something like that. So things are happening that maybe wouldn't have been thinkable 7 years ago, but it's, again, a kind of a slow and cumulative process.
And have you gotten a sense for if this is affecting the people who are in charge of, let's say, U.S. foreign policy? Because one of my impressions of, for instance, the Left Behind series is that some of these people definitely believe in, you know, the end times and this, you know, Armageddon.
Well, I'm not quite sure about, you know, say, Bush himself. I have never been able to kind of figure out the exact mix of cynicism and fanaticism in his character. My sense is that he has, you know, kind of messianic complex. I'm not sure that he's a true believer in this whole movement. You know, I think he's much more concerned about his, you know, kind of personal aggrandizement than any kind of, you know, doctrinal purity. But the two ways that you see this movement really playing out in terms of foreign policy, well, there's a couple ways, actually. I mean, you see it in terms of this, you know, widespread support for an incredibly hawkish policy in the Middle East, and which takes on these kind of eschatological overtones because you have, you know, millions and millions of people in the United States who believe that the world is going to end in a third world war in the Middle East, and only that can that's necessary to precede the second coming of Christ. So even if you don't even want to kind of actively bring about the second coming of Christ, the very fact that you see a third world war in the Middle East as being kind of necessary precondition to paradise is going to mean that you're not going to believe that a third world war in the Middle East needs to be pretty much avoided at almost all costs. You also see people with these kind of very, you know, quite radical views at pretty high levels in the military. And there have been a number of scandals about intense proselytization in the military and kind of harassment of non-evangelicals in the military. There was this famous case a couple of years ago of this guy, William Boykin, who was, you know, putting on his military uniform and going around to churches and talking about how, you know, we're in this battle between Christianity and Islam. And he talked about his experiences in Somalia when he was involved in the Black Hawk Down mission there, or the mission that inspired, you know, that gave us Black Hawk Down. And he talked about, you know, well, he was talking about this warlord and saying, I knew that I would defeat him because my God is a real God and his God is an idol. And probably even more disturbing is that he had these large photographs of Mogadishu with this kind of black smudge in one of the corners, and he would point to this smudge and say, and here we have photographic evidence of demonic activity over the city of Mogadishu. And so you would think, you know, that this would be discrediting. But instead, you know, he's been promoted and is now in charge of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. And so I think, again, one of the big stories I try to tell in this book is the kind of mainstreaming and legitimizing of the totally irrational.
So if you could briefly talk about any local connections here in Seattle to this bigger movement.
Sure. Well, probably the most famous local connection is the Discovery Institute, which is, you know, I was talking before about the creation of these kind of parallel institutions. And that's a really great example because the Discovery Institute, and particularly the Center for Science and Culture, which is within the Discovery Institute, which is the home of intelligent design, which is kind of the latest iteration of creationism, but is much more savvy than creationists past because they really go out of their way to kind of mimic the speech, the arguments, you know, the kind of forms of secular scientific culture, and to present intelligent design as if it were a scientific challenge to creationism, when in fact its roots are almost entirely theological. And in internal documents, the Discovery Institute makes pretty clear that its aims are theological. You know, its aims are really the undermining of, you know, what they call scientific materialism, you know, and Freud, Marx, Darwin, you know, kind of their aims are really the kind of undermining of modernity and replacing it with a kind of theistic conception of reality. But they present themselves and they recruit scientists. You know, some of the people at the Discovery Institute have advanced degrees from, you know, very, very prestigious schools. You know, often they're people who have said that they went to these schools specifically to have the degrees that would legitimate their attacks on evolution. But they're able to kind of be taken seriously in the public arena. And what they do is they try to create the image of the image that there's a controversy over evolution. So that it be, you know, and their slogan is often teach the controversy. You know, what are those what are those evolutionists afraid of? You know, can't we have hear both sides? And, but, you know, of course, there aren't both sides to every issue. We don't teach, you know, kind of heliocentrism and then the other side. We don't teach geocentrism. Well, some people say that the Earth revolves around the sun. Other people say the sun revolves around the Earth. Let's teach both sides of that issue. But that's essentially what they would like to do when it comes to the teaching of biology.
We've just been talking with Michelle Goldberg. She is an investigative writer and author, and out with the new paperback edition of her book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism.
And the interviewer was Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle. In the interview we just heard, author Michelle Goldberg speaks of the Christian Reich's attempt to create an alternative history of America. But the history we're taught in school, let's call it mainstream history, is already a highly manipulated tale, imbued with lies, omissions, and propaganda. In our last reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, we heard how the, quote, alien cultures of immigrants at the turn of the 20th century threatened the power relationships and social vision of the descendants of earlier colonists, and how they strove to create hereditary justification for their social primacy, which was manifested in the proliferation of societies based on Anglo-Saxon descent, and which used scientific and linguistic discoveries to formulate the idea of a great race, which came to be called Aryan, whose destiny and nature was to dominate others due to its superiority. Yes, the ideas of Nazism did not begin with Hitler and the Third Reich. This so-called racial superiority was deemed the cultural standard to which all Americans should aspire, and became the justification for a vast endeavor of social engineering, of deliberate cultural creation, of which compulsory schooling was a key component. If you're just joining the program, the book The Underground History of American Education is a meticulously researched and footnoted work 10 years in the making. Its author, John Taylor Gatto, spent 3 decades as a school teacher in New York City. He was at the pinnacle of his career, having been named New York State Teacher of the Year, when he announced he was quitting the profession because he'd concluded that the school system was harming the minds of children rather than developing them, as was its putative purpose. Gatto set out to examine the history of the education system, and learned that it was never intended to produce a nation of creative and independent thinkers. Very much the opposite. It was geared toward mediocrity, obedience and conformity, creation of a controllable and predictable population suitable to the mass marketing of consumer products. Last time we left off with Gatto's discussion of the ideas of Sir Henry James Sumner Mayne, a 19th-century English comparative jurist and historian who took upon himself the task of presenting the Aryan tribal character and tying it to contemporary Anglo-Saxons. Gatto wrote, quote, "In the crucial year which saw Darwin's Descent of Man published, Mayne's spectacular Village Communities in the East and West showed the world the rough-hewn genius of the primitive Anglo-Saxon world. Mayne reiterated his contention that stranger adoption was among the critical discoveries which led to Anglo-Saxon greatness. This message fell on particularly fertile ground in New England, whose soil had been prepared for this exact message by centuries of reading the New England Primer with its grim warning that children are only loaned to their parents." And what a message Mayne carried. Society thrived when children were detached from their own parents and cultures. It was a potent foundation on which to set the institution of forced schooling. Appearing shortly after the radical Massachusetts adoption law intended to disassemble Irish immigrant families, Mayne silenced the new institution's critics, paving the way for eventual resignation to long-term school incarceration, too. Close quote. And we continue with a discussion of the role of Mayne's ideas in Chapter 12 of The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Mayne built a stronger case in each successive book, Early History of Institutions in 1875 and Early Law and Custom in 1883. his magnificent tour de force, popular government, in 1885, smashed the very basis for popular democracy. After Maine, only a fool could believe non-Anglo-Saxon groups should participate as equals in important decision-making. At the same time, Maine's forceful dismissal of the fundamental equality of ordinary or different peoples was confirmed by the academic science of evolution and by commercial and manufacturing interests eager to collapse smaller enterprises into larger ones. Maine's regal pronouncements were supported by mainstream urban Protestant churches and by established middle classes. Democratic America had been given its death sentence. Sir Henry's work became a favorite text for sermons, lectures, Chautauqua Magazine journalism, and for the conversation of the best people. His effect is reflected symbolically in a resolution from the Scranton Board of Trade, of all places, which characterized immigrants as, quote, the most ignorant and vicious of European populations, including necessarily a vast number of the criminal class, people who came here not to be good citizens, but to prey upon our people and our industries, a class utterly without character and incapable of understanding or appreciating our institutions, and therefore a menace to our commonwealth, close quote. Popular government was deliberately unpopular in tone. There was no connection between democracy and progress. The reverse was true. Maine's account of racial history was accepted widely by the prosperous. It admirably complemented the torrent of scientifically mathematized racism pouring out of MIT, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, and virtually every bastion of high academia right through the World War I period and even beyond. Scientific racism determined the shape of government schooling in large measure, and still does. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Aryans, said Maine, were not overly sentimental about children. They maintained the right to kill or sell their children, and carried this custom with them as they spread over the earth, almost up to the outskirts of modern Beijing. These great ones had an intensely practical streak, tending to extract from every association its maximum payoff. This pragmatism led them to extend privileges of kinship to every association in which a good chance of profit might lurk. This casual disregard of blood ties led to powerful alliances much more adaptable to local circumstance than any pure blood allegiance system could be, such as the one of the Japanese practice. In other words, Anglo-Saxons were prepared to call anyone family for a price. Similarly, Anglo-Saxon ties to priests and gods were mostly ceremonial. All rules, ethics, and morals were kept flexible, relative to the needs of the moment. This lack of commitment to much of anything except possessions allowed Aryans to overturn local ways in which people held to principles and to local faith. Pragmatism was an impressive and effective technological advance in politics, if not in morality. In the science of society, the leadership reserved the right to lie, cheat, deceive, and be generally faithless wherever advantage presented itself, and not only to do these things to the enemy, but to one's own people if need be, a moral code well suited to a fast-moving warrior people. But a price had to be paid. Over time, the idea of real kinship became more and more fictitious. Family life characterized as much by ritual and ceremony as love. And in many places, said Maine, kinship, owing to mass adoption of children from conquered peoples, became mythical for whole clans. Nobody was who they said they were or thought themselves to be. It is surely one of the grim ironies of history that the root identity of American elites was crystallizing at the turn of the century around blood relationships to a warrior people so indifferent to blood relationships they often had no idea who they really were. With Anglo-Saxons, the abstract principle always counted for more than flesh and blood. Once the character of the Aryans was known, there remained only the task of establishing the homeland, the ancient forge of these virile conquerors. The behavioral ideals they willed to their descendants to impose upon lesser peoples were written clearly enough on the chalkboards of the new schooling. Total submission led the list, but giving the Aryans a birthplace, assuming it was the right one, would complete the circle of triumph. To the elite mind, that job was over by 1880. The ancient ancestor could now be fixed by common agreement somewhere in the cold north around the Baltic Sea. Some said Scandinavia. Some said north-central Germany. But the chief detectives holding the Anglo-American franchise on truth homed in on that zone between the Elbe and the Oder rivers to the lands compromising the regions of modern Prussia. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. The widow of the man who perfected the machine gun founded the Hotchkiss School. A Lowell and a Forbes funded Middlesex. The DuPonts were the patrons of Kent. St. George's was underwritten by the Brown family, whose name graces Brown University. Choate looked to the Mellon family for generous checks. J.P. Morgan was behind Groton. Over 90% of the great American private boarding schools issued from that short period, just after Herbert Spencer's American visit in 1882, and just before the indirect edict to the National Education Association that it must play ball with the de-intellectualization of public schooling, or it would be abandoned by America's business leadership. Elite private boarding schools were an important cornerstone in the foundation of a permanent American upper class, whose children were to be socialized for power. They were great schools for the great race, intended to forge a collective identity among children of privilege, training them to be bankers, financiers, partners in law firms, corporate directors, negotiators of international treaties and contracts, patrons of the arts, philanthropists, directors of welfare organizations, members of advisory panels, government elites, and business elites. Michael Yuseem's post-World War II study showed that just 13 elite boarding schools educated 10% of all the directors of large American business corporations, and 15% of all the directors who held three or more directorships. These schools collectively graduated fewer than 1,000 students a year. More spectacular pedagogy than that is hard to imagine. In England, the pioneer feminist Victoria Woodhull published The Rapid Multiplication of the Unfit. And in the States, Edward A. Ross, trained in Germany, University of Wisconsin pioneer of American sociology, was writing The Old World in the New, saying that beaten members of beaten breeds would destroy us unless placed under control. They were, quote, subhuman. Ross was joined by virtually every leading social scientist of his generation in warning about the ill effects of blood pollution. Richard Ely, William Z. Ripley, Richard Mayo Smith, John R. Commons, Davis Dewey, Franklin Giddings, and many more. None disagreed with Ross. Morons were multiplying. The government had to be made aware of the biological consequences of social policy. But while beaten members of beaten breeds had to be zipped up tight in isolation, ward schools and neighborhoods of their own, watched over by social gospelers, settlement houses, and social workers trained in the new social science, a new American social dimension was being created from scratch, in which the best people could associate freely, could rear their children properly, could reap rewards they deserved as the most advanced class on the evolutionary tree. That was not only justice, it was prudent preparation for an even better biological future. The way the new shadow society, a universe parallel to the one everyone else could see, had to operate after it first constructed for itself a theory of establishment and a theology of caste, was by creating a new social structure, corporate in nature. in which man was progressively defined by those with whom he affiliated, his synthetic associational tribe, not by his independent talents and accomplishments. If these affiliations were only local, then status was correspondingly diminished. The trick was to progressively graduate to memberships which had regional, national, or even international status, and this associated prestige would then be transferred to the individual. What a perfect way of keeping out the riffraff and porch monkeys this would prove to be. It was no idle boast, nor was the statement a simple expression of snobbery when John Lupton, the director of development at the Choate School in Wallingford, Connecticut, said, quote, "There is no door in this entire country that cannot be opened by a Choate graduate. I can go anywhere in this country, and anywhere there's a man I want to see, I can find a Choate man to open that door for me." Close quote. The crucial variables in identifying the right people in the new exclusionary America no longer included high-profile expressions of superiority. What they did include were, 1, membership in the right metropolitan clubs, 2, an address in the right neighborhoods, 3, a degree from the right college, 4, a membership in the right country club, 5, attendance at the right summer resorts, 6, attendance at the right churches, 7, passage through the right private schools, 8, an invitation to the right hereditary association, 9, involvement in the right charities, 10, trusteeships, boards, advisory councils, 11, the right marriages, alliances, a social register listing, 12, money, manners, style, physical beauty, health, conversation. I've made no attempt to enter subtleties of gradation, only to indicate how the E4s behind public schooling and virtually all significant decision-making in modern American society created, quite self-consciously, a well-regulated world within a world for themselves. Provision was made to allow some movement up from other classes. Clubs, for instance, were also agencies for assimilating men of talent and their families into an upper-class way of life and social organization. If we are unwilling to face how very far-reaching the effects of this American establishment are to school children, there's just no good way to think about school reform. Darwin's evolutionary racism, Galton's mathematical racism, Maine's anthropological racism, Anglican theological racism classism, all are deeply embedded in the structure of mass schooling and the economy it serves. They cannot be extirpated by rational discussion. These viruses are carried by institutional structures not amenable to social discussion. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The new American establishment of the 20th century was organized around the fountains of wealth international corporate business provides. By 1900, huge businesses had already begun to dominate American schooling, and the metropolitan clubs where business was transacted lay at the core of upper-class authority in every major city in the nation. The men's club emerged as the principal agency where business agreements were struck and indirectly where school policy was forged. In 1959, Fortune magazine shocked a portion of our still innocent nation by announcing where national policy and important deals were really made in New York City. If the matter was relatively minor, the venue would be the Metropolitan, the Union League, or the university. If it were a middling matter, it would be determined at the Knickerbocker or the Racket, and if it required the utmost attention of powerful men, Brook or Lynx. Nothing happened in boardrooms or executive suites where it could be overheard by outlanders. Each city had this private ground where aristocracy met quietly out of reach of prying eyes or unwelcome attendance. In San Francisco, the Pacific Union. In Washington, Cosmos or the Chevy Chase. The Somerset in Boston. Duquesne in Pittsburgh. The Philadelphia Club in Philadelphia. The Chicago Club in Chicago. Once hands were shaken in these places, the process of public debate and certification were choreographed elsewhere for public and press. government business came to be done this way, too. The entire web of affiliations among insiders in business, government, and the nonprofit sector operates through interpersonal and institutional ties which interconnect at the highest levels of finance, politics, commerce, school affairs, social work, the arts, and media. Continuing conflicts of value within the leadership community give an appearance of adversarial proceedings, but each passing decade brings more and more harmony to the unseen community which plans the fate of schools and work. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Reading through the papers of the Rockefeller Foundation's General Education Board, an endowment rivaled in school policy influence in the first half of the 20th century only by Andrew Carnegie's various philanthropies, seven curious elements force themselves on the careful reader. 1. There appears a clear intention to mold people through schooling. 2. There is a clear intention to eliminate tradition and scholarship. 3. The net effect of various projects is to create a strong class system verging on caste. 4. There is a clear intention to reduce mass critical intelligence while supporting infinite specialization. 5. There is a clear intention to weaken parental influence. 6. There is a clear intention to overthrow accepted custom. 7. There is a striking congruency between the cumulative purposes of GEB projects and the utopian precepts of the oddball religious sect, once known as perfectionism, a secular religion aimed at making the perfection of human nature, not salvation or happiness, the purpose of existence. The agenda of philanthropy, which had so much to do with the schools we got, turns out to contain an intensely political component. This is not to deny that genuine altruistic interests aren't also a part of philanthropy, but as Ellen Lagerman correctly reflects in her interesting history of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, Private Power for the Public Good, quote, in advancing some interests, foundations have inevitably not advanced others. Hence, their actions must have political consequences, even when political purposes are not avowed or even intended. To avoid politics in dealing with foundation history is to miss a crucial part of the story, close quote. Edward Berman, in Harvard Education Review 49, published in 1979, puts it more brusquely. Focusing on Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford philanthropies, he concludes that, quote, public rhetoric of disinterested humanitarianism was little more than a facade, behind which the interests of the political state, not necessarily those of society, have been actively furthered. The rise of foundations to key positions in educational policy formation amounted to what Clarence Carrier called, quote, the development of a fourth branch of government, one that effectively represents the interests of American corporate wealth, close quote. The corporate foundation is mainly a 20th century phenomenon, growing from 21 specimens of the breed in 1900 to approximately 50,000 by 1990. From the beginning, foundations aimed squarely at educational policy formation. Rockefeller's General Education Board obtained an incorporating act from Congress in 1903 and immediately began to organize schooling in the South, joining the old Slater cotton-woolen manufacturing interests and Peabody's banking interests in a coalition in which Rockefeller picked up many of the bills. From the start, the GEB had a mission. A letter from John D. Rockefeller Sr. specified that his gifts were to be used to, quote, promote a comprehensive system. You might well ask what interests the system was designed to promote, but you would be asking the wrong question. Frederick Gates, the Baptist minister hired to disburse Rockefeller largesse, gave a terse explanation when he said, the key word is system. American life was too unsystematic to suit corporate genius. Rockefeller's foundation was about systematizing us. In 1913, the 62nd Congress created a commission to investigate the role of these new foundations of Carnegie, Rockefeller, and of other corporate families. After a year of testimony, it concluded, quote, "The domination of man, in whose hands the final control of a large part of American industry rests, is not limited to their employees, but is being rapidly extended to control the education and social services of the nation." Close quote. Foundation grants directly enhance the interests of the corporations sponsoring them, it found. The conclusion of this congressional commission, quote, "The giant foundation exercises enormous power through direct use of its funds, free of any statutory entanglements, so they can be directed precisely to the levers of a situation. This power, however, is substantially increased by building collateral alliances which insulate it from criticism and scrutiny." Close quote. Foundations automatically make friends among banks which hold their large deposits, in investment houses which multiply their monies, in law firms which act as their counsels, and with many firms, institutions, and individuals with which they deal and whom they benefit. By careful selection of trustees from the right ranks of high editorial personnel and other media executives and proprietors, they can assure themselves press support, and by engaging public relations counselors can further create good publicity. As Renee Wurmser, chief counsel for the Second Congressional Inquiry into Foundation Life of 1958, put it, quote, "All its connections and associations, plus the often sycophantic adulation of the many institutions and individuals who receive largesse from the foundation, give it an enormous aggregate of power and influence. This power extends beyond its immediate circle of associations to those who hope to benefit from its bounty." Close quote. In 1919, using Rockefeller money, John Dewey, by now a professor at Columbia Teachers College, an institution heavily endowed by Rockefeller, founded the Progressive Education Association. Through its existence, it spread the philosophy which undergirds welfare capitalism, that the bulk of the population is biologically childlike, requiring lifelong care. From the start, Dewey was joined by other Columbia professors who made it no secret that the objective of the PEA project was to use the educational system as a tool to accomplish its political goals. In The Great Technology, published in 1933, Harold Rugg elucidated the grand vision, quote, "A new public mind is to be created. How? Only by creating tens of millions of individual minds and welding them into a new social mind. Old stereotypes must be broken up and new climates of opinion formed in the neighborhoods of America. Through the schools of the world, we shall disseminate a new conception of government, one that will embrace all the activities of men, one that will postulate the need of scientific control in the interest of all people." Close quote. In similar fashion, the work of the Social Science Research Council culminated in a statement of conclusions and recommendations on its Carnegie Foundation-funded operations, which had enormous and lasting impact upon education in the United States. Conclusions, published in 1934, heralded the decline of the old order, stating aggressively that, quote, "a new age of collectivism is emerging," close quote, "which will involve the supplanting of private property by public property and will require experimentation and almost certainly a large measure of compulsory cooperation of citizens, a corresponding enlargement of the functions of government, and increasing state intervention. Rights will be altered and abridged," close quote. Conclusions was a call to the teachers' colleges to instruct their students to condition children into an acceptance of the new order in progress. Reading, writing, and arithmetic were to be marginalized as irrelevant, even counterproductive. Quote, "As often repeated, the first step is to consolidate leadership around the philosophy and purpose of education herein expounded." Close quote. The difficulties in trying to understand what such an odd locution as compulsory cooperation might really mean, or even trying to determine what historic definition of education would fit such a usage, were ignored. To those who wrote this report, and some of those who read it, were the only ones who held the Rosetta Stone to decipher it. In an article in Progressive Education magazine, Professor Norman Wolfel produced one of the many children and grandchildren of the conclusions report when he wrote in 1946, quote, "It might be necessary for us to control our press as the Russian press is controlled and as the Nazi press is controlled," close quote. A startling conclusion he improved upon in his book Molders of the American Mind, published in 1933, with this dark beauty, quote, "In the minds of men who think experimentally, America is conceived as having a destiny which bursts the all-too-obvious limitations of Christian religious sanctions," close quote. The Rockefeller-endowed Lincoln Experimental School at Columbia Teachers College was a testing ground for Harold Rugg's series of textbooks, which moved 5 million copies by 1940, and millions more after that. In these books, Rugg advanced his theory, quote, "Education must be used to condition the people to accept social change. The chief function of schools is to plan the future of society," close quote. Like many of his activities over three vital decades on the school front, the notions Rugg put forth in The Great Technology, published in 1933, were eventually translated into practice in urban centers. Rugg advocated the major task of schools be seen as indoctrinating youth, using social science as the, quote, "core of the school curriculum," to bring about the desired climate of public opinion. Some attitudes Rugg advocated teaching were reconstruction of the national economic system to provide for central controls and an implantation of the attitude that educators as a group were a, quote, "vastly superior priesthood." "Our task is to create swiftly a compact body of minority opinion for the scientific reconstruction of our social order." Money for Rugg's six textbooks came from Rockefeller Foundation grants to the Lincoln School. He was paid two salaries by the foundation, one as an educational psychologist for Lincoln, the other as professor of education at Teachers College, in addition to salaries for secretarial and research services. The General Education Board provided funds equivalent to $500,000 in year 2000 purchasing power to produce three books, which were then distributed by the National Education Association. In 1954, a second congressional investigation of foundation tampering with schools and American social life was attempted, headed by Carol Reese of Tennessee. The Reese Commission quickly ran into a buzzsaw of opposition from influential centers of American corporate life. Major national newspapers hurled scathing criticisms, which, together with pressure from other potent political adversaries, forced the committee to disband prematurely, but not before there were some tentative findings. Quote, "The power of the individual large foundations is enormous. Its various forms of patronage carry with them elements of thought control. It exerts immense influence on educator, educational processes, and educational institutions. It is capable of invisible coercion. It can materially predetermine the development of social and political concepts, academic opinion, thought leadership, public opinion. The power to influence national policy is amplified tremendously when foundations act in concert. There is such a concentration of foundation power in the United States, operating in education and the social sciences, with the gigantic aggregate of capital and income. This interlock has some of the characteristics of an intellectual cartel. It operates in part through certain intermediary organizations supported by the foundations. It has ramifications in almost every phase of education. It has come to exercise very extensive practical control over social science and education. A system has arisen which gives enormous power to a relatively small group of individuals, having at their virtual command huge sums in public trust funds. The power of the large foundations and the interlock has so influenced press, radio, television, and even government that it has become extremely difficult for objective criticism of anything the interlock approves to get into news channels without having first been ridiculed, slanted, and discredited. Research in the social sciences plays a key part in the evolution of our society. Such research is now almost wholly in the control of professional employees of the large foundations. Even the great sums allotted by federal government to social science research have come into the virtual control of this professional group. Foundations have promoted a great excess of empirical research as contrasted with theoretical research, promoting an irresponsible fact-finding mania, leading all too frequently to scientism or fake science. Associated with the excessive support of empirical method, the concentration of foundation power has tended to promote moral relativity to the detriment of our basic moral, religious, and governmental principles. It has tended to promote the concept of social engineering, that foundation-approved social scientists alone are capable of guiding us into better ways of living, substituting synthetic principles for fundamental principles of action. These foundations and their intermediaries engage extensively in political activity, not in the form of direct support of candidates or parties, but in the conscious promotion of carefully calculated political concepts. The impact of foundation money upon education has been very heavy, tending to promote uniformity in approach and method, tending to induce the educator to become an agent for social change and a propagandist for the development of our society in the direction of some form of collectivism. In the international field, foundations and the Interlock, together with intermediary organizations, have exercised a strong effect upon foreign policy and upon public education in things international. This has been accomplished by vast propaganda, by supplying executives and advisors to government, and by controlling research through the power of the purse. The net result has been to promote, quote, internationalism in a particular sense, a form directed toward world government and a derogation of American nationalism. Close quote. Hence, we find ourselves confronted with the puzzling duty of interpreting why two separate congressional committees convened 50 years apart to study the working of the new foundation institutions, one under a Democratic Congress, one under a Republican Congress, both reached essentially the same conclusions. Both adjudged foundations a clear and present danger to the traditional liberties of American national life. Both pointed to the use of foundation influence to create the blueprint of American school life. Both saw that a class system in America had emerged and was being supported by the class system in schooling. Both called for drastic action, and both were totally ignored. Actually, the word ignored doesn't begin to do justice to what really occurred. These congressional investigations, like Sir Walter Scott's difficult-to-obtain Life of Napoleon Bonaparte, have not only vanished from public imagination, they aren't even alluded to in press discussions of schooling, exactly as if they had never happened. This would be more understandable if their specific philanthropies were dull, pedestrian giveaways designed to distribute largesse and build up good feeling toward the benevolence of colossal wealth and power. But the reality is strikingly different. A corporate wealth through the foundations has advanced importantly the dumbing down of America's schools, the creation of a scientific class system, and important attacks on family integrity, national identification, religious rights, and national sovereignty. School is the cheapest police, Horace Mann said. Sears, Pierce, Harris, Stowe, Lancaster, and the rest, prominently involved in creating universal school systems for coal powers. One only has to browse Merle Curti's The Social Ideas of American Educators to discover that the greatest social idea educators had to sell the rich, and which they lost no opportunity to sell, was the police function of schooling. Although a pedagogical turn in the Quaker imagination is the reason schools came to look like penitentiaries, Quakers are not the principal reason they came to function like maximum security institutions. The reason they came to exist at all was to stabilize the social order and train the ranks. In a scientific, industrialized, corporate age, stability was much more exquisitely defined than ordinary people could imagine. To realize the new stability, the best breeding stock had to be drawn up into reservations. Likewise, the ordinary. The Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede is only a small piece of the puzzle. Many more efficient and subtler quarantines were essayed. I'll just interject here that the Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede, which is actually the title of this chapter, refers to one of the hereditary societies of Anglo-Saxon blood that was established during the time period in question as part of the bringing of caste to American society, says Gatto. And I will continue. Perhaps subtlest of all was the welfare state, a welfare program for everybody, including the lowest, in which the political state bestowed alms the way the corporate church used to do. Although the most visible beneficiaries of this gigantic project were those groups increasingly referred to as masses, the poor were actually people most poorly served by this latter-day Hindu creation of Fabian socialism and the corporate brain trust. Subsidizing the excluded of the new society and economy was, it was believed, a humanitarian way to calm these troubled waters until the Darwinian storm had run its inevitable course into a new genetically arranged utopia. A report issued in 1982 and widely publicized in important journals, the connection between corporate capitalism and the welfare state becomes manifest in a public document bearing the name Alan Pfeiffer, then president of the Carnegie Corporation. Apparently fearing that the Reagan administration would alter the design of the Fabian Project beyond its ability to survive, Pfeiffer warned of, quote, a mounting possibility of severe social unrest and the consequent development among the upper classes and the business community of sufficient fear for the survival of our capitalist economic system to bring about an abrupt change of course. Just as we built the general welfare state and expanded it in the 1960s as a safety valve for the easing of social tension, so we will do it again in the 1980s. Any other path is too risky, close quote. In the report quoted from, new conceptions of pedagogy were introduced, which we now see struggling to be born. National certification for school teachers, bypassing the last vestige of local control in states, cities, and villages. A hierarchy of teachers' positions, a project to bring an end to the hierarchy of school administrators, now adjudged largely an expenditure counterproductive to good social order, a failed experiment. In the new form, lead teachers manage schools after the British fashion and hire business administrators. The first expressions of this new initiative included the mini-school movement, now evolved into the charter school movement. Without denying these ideas a measure of merit, if you understand that their source is the same institutional consciousness which once sent river ironclads full of armed detectives to break the steel union at Homestead, machine gun strikers at River Rouge, and burn to death over a dozen women and children in Ludlow, those memories should inspire emotions more pensive than starry-eyed enthusiasm. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. That was the conclusion of Chapter 12, The Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede. You can find out more about John Taylor Gatto's work and download this entire book for free online at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. And Gatto has two T's. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by